With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know.
And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
With the outcome of the general election, we find ourselves in a position unknown to this generation of political leaders. With no single party able to have a commons majority and therefore have a majority government.
Last night was a disappointment for the Liberal Democrats, even though more people voted for us than ever before. Yeah,
the Conservative Party gained more seats than at any election for the last 80 years. I'm incredibly proud, not only of the strong result that we achieved, but of the strong and positive campaign that we fought.
It's a good delivery. It was the closest we've seen to a goal so far, and it's the big man Isaac Forster who has headed this one fractionally wide. If they're going to get a goal, they're going to have to get it in the next 20 seconds, and Montari goes for goal! What did I say? With 15 seconds on the clock in the opening half, Africa strikes, Ghana strikes, and Sully Montari has got the only goal of this half. It is Uruguay 0, Ghana 1 against all the odds.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller. With me, of course, is Jonathan Wilson. And with us is BBC Football 5 Live Match of the Day commentator, Conor McNamara. Conor, pleasure to have you on the show.
Hi, guys. Very nice to join you. Very nice to have something else to do during the lockdown.
Well, we should say that we have a lot of these podcasts recorded and kind of stacked up, but we've started to record some during the lockdown, as you say, Conor. So wherever you may be listening to this, who knows what the news is and what the current affairs are, but we are very much remotely recording this, which is a shame not to be in your company, Conor. But anyway, we're gonna press on no matter what. So today, Conor, we go back to the World Cup in 2010, the quarterfinal between Uruguay and Ghana. Uruguay, of course, won 4-2 on penalties after 1-1 after extra time. Conor, why have you chosen this game?
Well, when you guys first approached me about picking out a greatest game, it is difficult, and it's funny, you know, sometimes when you finish a game and you think, wow, I'll never forget that. And it's funny, over the course of time, you begin to forget little details of games, and you might remember one particular moment, a piece of skill, or, you know, very often you'll remember a brilliant goal. But this is a game that has always stood out for me, that at the end of the commentary, I was working with John Murray, who's the BBC's football correspondent, who's a very good friend of mine. Chris Waddle was the summariser, who's one of my favourite pundits to work with. And Mark Chapman was presenting with us in the stadium. I remember we went for a beer later and we all looked around and we said, this is one game we are never, ever going to forget. It was so dramatic. And there was a little, and I'll give you a sort of small bit of background to this. You won't have to be totally Sherlock Holmes to work it out, but I'm not going to name all names involved. The other quarterfinal ended up being Brazil against Holland. And in our original schedule, the city I was supposed to be in, the game I was supposed to do that quarterfinal. And this is all sort of planned out in advance before we know how the games are going to work out. And then a certain colleague of mine, a more high-profile colleague of mine, pulled rank and insisted that he was going to be involved for the Brazil-Holland game. Because obviously with the way the second rounds have worked, I was like, oh my God, this is going to be Brazil-Holland. This is going to be one of my best games I'll ever get to do. And I got bumped off Brazil-Holland and I got sent to do Uruguay-Ghana, which, let's face it, on paper in advance, does not have the exotic tinge to it. And yet, isn't it funny how life works out that Brazil-Holland was not a memorable game, whereas Uruguay against Ghana was widely accepted to be the most exciting match of the tournament. So you never know in football. Never judge the book by its cover. You never know what you're going to get.
Yeah, Jonathan, I mean, it was an explosive end to the game, certainly, which we will get on to, of course. But it was one of the most memorable moments in recent sort of World Cup history. Although it was a rare moment of real sort of drama, if you like, in a tournament which wasn't that great on the field. You had the great backdrop of South Africa, of course, but I know you're not a huge fan of this tournament.
Yeah, I mean, the problem when you cover a tournament, and particularly a World Cup when it's, you know, 5 weeks long, is that so much of the background detail shapes how you feel about the tournament. So I've done four World Cups now, and this, by some margin, was the one I enjoyed the least. And I think part of that was I'd been looking forward to it so much. You know, I'd covered, at that point, I'd done, what, five Cups of Nations. I mean, this Ghana team had done very well in Angola in early in the year in 2010, based around the Ghana team that had won the Under-20 World Cup the previous year. And so, you know, there's an excitement about them and just the story of the tournament going to Africa. But actually, I ended up stuck in Rustenburg. It was freezing cold. England were terrible. I was covering England, which is never a good thing to do at a tournament.
Not a concern of Connors, of course.
I actually saw. I ended up seeing Ghana three times in this tournament. So I saw their games in the group against Australia. I saw them in the last 16 against the USA, and I saw this game. And Ghana were, you know, for me, the best thing about the tournament. But, you know, it was. South Africa is a very difficult country to get around. It's not a country that's easy to relax in, or certainly parts of it are not easy to relax in. And by this stage, I was totally frazzled. So that, you know, the sort of sense of it not quite living up to what I thought it could be, so slightly infected how I felt about it. And, you know, even looking back at this game, the two goals that are scored, both of them are to do with the ball. And the ball absolutely ruined the quality of football in this tournament, as it had ruined the Cup of Nations in Angola earlier in the year, which we hadn't really realised in Angola. We just thought it was a bad tournament. But that ball great footballers couldn't control it.
Yeah. So I had to get the negativity out of the way there, Connor. I know Jonathan has a bit.
Yeah, I've unloaded. I'm free of it now.
it's funny, you know, there's a thread to this. I mean, when I've been lucky to work at a similar amount of World Cups to Jonathan, and there is undoubtedly a thread of people who are in camps with England and go through what I think is maybe similar to a hostage situation. They come out the end of it and they very seldom have great things to say about the World Cup. And I totally appreciate you. If you are a journalist, you're working in the UK, that's probably the height of your career is to get to cover England at a World Cup. And, you know, I'm sure they're all delighted to be there. But from the outside looking in, it doesn't look like an awful lot of fun. Whereas, you know, I got to travel around the country and I got to see all the other teams in action. And, you know, you're commentating on a Argentina side that had Messi and Tevez in it, and you're commentating on a French team who were sort of imploded, and there's various, you know, great elements and memories that you get from it. But yeah, looking back now, I remember the Frank Lampard goal that was disallowed. I can't really remember anything else that England did at that tournament.
Yeah,
well, there was John Terry's famous stand against Capello, which was hilarious, one of the great press conferences. But I mean, we don't go to the World Cups for the press conferences, let's be honest.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. Indeed. I certainly envy you, Connor, if that's the only thing that you can remember about England. but let's leave England there, this tournament, leave that well behind us. How did you find the World Cup in South Africa, Connor? I mean, Jonathan had been to many Cup of Nations and so on. I'm not sure if you had much previous working.
No, I've been to Africa, not been to South Africa, and I haven't been since. I think, you know, build up to any tournament, you're so excited to go there, a new place, exotic, first World Cup to be held in Africa. There was obviously loads of build up to do with that. I remember my first impression of being there maybe a week, and I thought, okay, there's great natural beauty here. I thought the food was really nice, but I thought, hand on heart, I can't see myself coming here on a family holiday. I mean, all the buildings, and I mean all the buildings, had barbed wire on them, high fences. There was this, and I didn't see any danger. I didn't see any violence, but there was always this tinge of, oh, well, bad things must go on here on a regular basis because everyone is lived in a little, you know, maximum security prison. Every shop had bars in the windows, and it just had that sense of menace. And, you know, we're always told, working for the BBC, we get sent on these safety courses before we go to events, and, you know, caution, and always never go around on your own, and, you know, always be in a group, and only ever take the, you know, don't pick up a random taxi and end up, you know, being kidnapped. And I think on that trip, you definitely had, okay, I am not going out on my own. I'm going with other people. Now, but then it's funny, by the end of the tournament, that did soften a bit. And then you're thinking, oh, you know, I'd actually love to come back here and go on a wine tour. You know, just such is the natural beauty of the country. So yeah, it was a funny, there was an intimidating atmosphere at the start. And I think what didn't help in the early weeks of the tournament was the hosts being knocked out. I think it was the first time the hosts had ever been knocked out in the group stage. Hosts always go through. And South Africa didn't. And they were actually quite unlucky. I think they only lost one game. But just the way the groups sort of, they drew the opening match, that was against France. Then they lost to Uruguay, funny enough. And then, of course, they were beaten and they were out. And it almost felt a little bit flat. You know, you always want. I remember being in Brazil 2014, and when Brazil went out, which was much, much later in the tournament, but you felt, oh, you know, bit of the tournament is missing now, the hosts are out. It definitely felt that way. And then the other African teams, and there were quite a lot of African teams. Remember, the first World Cup in Africa, Nigeria finished bottom of their group. They were in with a difficult group. They were in Argentina. They were in with the reigning European champions of the time, Greece. Algeria were in England's group, bottom of the group. Cameroon, bottom of the group. Ivory Coast, I think they were third in the group, but they went out in the group stage. They only had one win. They beat North Korea. So Ghana undoubtedly were the African hope, and that's what made this quarterfinal so exciting and interesting at the time. But yeah, you really, as a neutral outsider, you wanted one of the African nations to be in it, just to keep that party vibe that you always associate with World Cups, where so many of the locals may not have tickets to be in the stand, but they are engaged with the World Cup and they're having street parties afterwards. And that's the kind of thing you want to be involved in. As soon as the hosts go out, invariably that flattens.
And even Ghana were actually quite fortunate to get through the group. You know, the Serbia-Australia game, Australia were 2-1 up with 5 minutes to go, and Serbia should have had a penalty. And if they'd been given that and scored it, Serbia would have gone through ahead of Ghana on goals scored. So we could have had a situation where all six African teams went out in the group stage. And I totally agree, that would have been devastating for, I mean, not just for the mood around the tournament, but I just sort of think for everything that was sort of built up upon the idea of sort of, you know, Africa finally being embraced by the World Game, FIFA finally saying, yes, you can host the World Cup. If then no team had gone through, that would have left everything so so flat and so depressed.
Yeah. What did you make of the Ghana side, though, Jonathan? I mean, I believe you were in the Africa Cup of Nations in Ghana 2 years previously. I was actually was there myself. And there was a great fanfare in the country. They were a bit disappointed that they were knocked out in the semi-finals. I think it was by Egypt, but that was when Egypt seemed to win the tournament in every other year. But Ghana, they had some players, you know, names that we would know. Suleiman Tari leaps to mind, and Jan, of course, or even John Pansel playing at Fulham, and one or two others. It was a decent side.
It was, and I suppose this relates back to what Connor said right at the beginning, that your memory plays tricks on you. So my memory of them in Angola was that they were that, you know, a really exciting, promising, fresh team. And I think that is true. There was four of that team. So there's Sammy Nkume, who was either an attacking right back or, you know, in this semi-final, he played on the right side of midfield. There's Andre Ayew, who, of course, has gone on to great things, although maybe not quite as great as we thought he had the potential to do. Emmanuel Agyeman Badu, who I think was injured and so missed the World Cup. And Jonathan Mensah, who was sort of a backup central defender. So the four of them had all played in the team that had won the Under-20 World Cup in 2009. When they played Uruguay in the group and drew 2-2, and Nicolas Ladera, who played in that game, came off the bench in this semi-final. So they were this young team. But my memory clearly had played tricks, because their record in Angola, they only played two group games because Togo, you know, there'd been a terror attack and Togo went home. They were well beaten by Cote d'Ivoire 3-1. And then they won the next three games 1-0. They won the final group game 1-0, and then they beat Angola in the quarter final, beat Nigeria in the semi, and then end up losing 1-0 again against Egypt. So they were actually, you know, a tight defensive team. They had Anthony Annan at the back of midfield, who was very important for them, and Kwadwo Asamoah, who was sort of a number 10 in those days. You know, he got converted to a left wing back at Juve, but you know, he was a sort of old school African playmaker back then. And so they were, even if he didn't score the goals, they were good to watch. And Jan is such a fascinating figure that, you know, in 2008 in Ghana, when you were there, I mean, you'd have experienced this, that he had a shocking start to the tournament and Ghana didn't play well. And he got an enormous amount of grief, which is so bad that he ended up walking out on the team. And his brother, who was also in the squad, Bafua, had to sort of drag him back. But he was sort of really scapegoated for their poor start to the tournament, which is why Junior Agogo got in the team and started scoring goals and became this totally implausible sort of overnight hero, sex symbol. Mm-hmm. But Asamoah Gyan had this terrible time. And then by 2010, you know, he's the hero again. And, you know, he's the player who's scoring the crucial goals in the group stage.
Mm. Yeah, we've talked a lot about Ghana, and we will do, of course. But what about Uruguay, Connor? You know, the first time they'd reached the semi-final, of course, in a while was in this tournament. But you look through that side, there's names that we've heard of, you know, much younger, of course, Diego Godin. You've got Diego Lugano, who was the captain. Muslera in goal, who went on to get, I don't know how many caps. You've got a 23-year-old Cavani, 23-year-old Suarez, who'd scored a few goals in previous rounds and previous games and so on. It was a decent Uruguay side with Oscar Tabárez in charge, who they would go on, of course, the year later to win the Copa America. I mean, what did you make of them leading into this match?
Yeah, I think Diego Forlán was the big star. He kind of had the blonde mane of hair. This wasn't the Forlán who was tepid at Manchester United. This was the Forlán who was a, you know, goal machine in La Liga. He very much he led in this swagger. He did everything slowly. He took the corners and he would wander slowly over to take the corner. When he took a penalty in the penalty shootout, he walked up with the ball in one hand, just so casual. So I've got this, lads. Don't worry. He was the star. I think you look now, you see Cavani, you see Suarez, you think, oh, they must have been the stars. But no, they were younger players then, but they were wild dogs. I mean, that team, you knew they were a team. You knew if one of them accidentally committed murder, The rest of them would be out with shovels. Don't worry. We'll dig a hole. We'll bury it. No one's going to find out. You know, that was a tight crew. You know what I'm saying? Those guys were not going to take prisoners.
Yeah. Yeah, I think when I think of that side, you're absolutely right. I think of who would it be? Correct me if I'm wrong here, Jonathan. Diego Perez in the center of the midfield with Pereira. There was a couple of Pereiras. Alvaro Pereira, I think. The two of them.
I think it was Maxi Maxi played in the semi-final.
Right, okay.
There was Alvaro Rios, who was a younger central midfielder. I think he was in his early 20s, but he was a sort of all, he was like Torreira, the Arsenal player now, sort of all-action midfielder.
Yeah, well, his nickname's Pac-Man because of the way he just sort of gobbled the ball up at the back of midfield. And he was you know, he's one of those players who, you know, never gets the recognition, but everything Uruguay did well, or have done well under Tabárez, he's been there. And you take him out of that and they lose so much because, you know, his discipline just to sit in front. I mean, I think particularly because they played so deep because of, you know, Lugano and then subsequently Godin lacking pace. And so they needed him to sort of sit in front of them and just sort of snaffle up loose balls and put in challenges, like real hard nut, proper sort of old school Uruguayan footballer.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's have a quick break, gentlemen, and after which we'll get into the game itself. See you in a moment, everybody.
Diego Forlan, a crucial moment in the match for Uruguay. Goal, Forlan. Clinically struck. It's 1-1, and it's from the right boot of Diego Forlan. Look at the bend on it again. Kingston actually went the right way ultimately, but couldn't get there.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the air in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
Join me, Pete Donaldson, and Japan-based YouTuber Chris Broad every Wednesday as we offer the lowdown on what's happening in one of the most unique and exciting countries in the world. The Abroad in Japan podcast is home to all things Japan, from things to do...
So today we've come to you guys with 12 places in Japan that nobody knows about.
...to the bizarre...
When I moved into my new apartment last year, the police guy came to my door, knocked on my door, I opened it, it was a policeman, and he said to me, in English, I am Japanese policeman. And I went, that's the best introduction you could possibly do as a Japanese policeman.
To the downright filthy.
And for those of you who don't know what a tenga is... Pete and I did discuss how to describe it best before doing the podcast, and I'll let Pete describe what a Tengger is. What is it, Pete?
It's a solo male silicon-based ordinist's aid, so to speak.
Brilliant.
New episodes every single Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Abroad in Japan is a Stakhanov production.
It could just slip away for Uruguay here at the very death of the match. Mensah will be one of those up for it. It's going to get the flick in, and Muslera, oh, cleared on the line, and cleared on the line a second. The referee's assistant is flagging. What a dramatic thing. There's a red card coming out as well. Well, there had to be drama right at the end here, and the red card is shown. Suarez is sent off. Well, you couldn't have a more dramatic finish to a World Cup match than this one.
Welcome back to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with the Blizzard. All right then, gentlemen. So it was the quarterfinal of the 2010 World Cup. Ghana had got there in a come out of a tricky group with Germany, Serbia, and Australia. They'd beaten the United States. And Uruguay themselves came through quite an odd group, as you mentioned earlier, Connor, with France kind of imploding South Africa and Mexico. And they'd beaten South Korea 2-1 in the previous round. So going into the game, Connor, when you were looking at those sides, did you – I mean, certainly my heart, and I think a lot of other neutrals were wanting Ghana to win, but who did you fancy going into this? Did you think it was fairly even, or did you think the can of Uruguayans might have them here?
Yeah, I think, look, it's obviously a really long time ago. I can't remember the exact sort of feeling I had going in, apart from, you know as neutral as you were, kind of wanting Ghana to go through for that African nation part. I mean, the game was played Soccer City. This was near Soweto area of Johannesburg. The location of it is quite significant, and for, you know, people in South Africa, the site where the stadium, and this is huge, I mean, this is bigger than Wembley, 95,000, I believe, is the sort of full capacity. I mean, because of the World Cup, they needed extra space for media and, you know, corporate stuff, so the attendance was below 90,000, but it was this massive stadium. It was the real symbol of the World Cup. This is what they put all the money into. But on that, before the stadium being built, that area, that site was where Mandela had made his first speech when he was released from prison. There was a politician, Chris Hani, was one of these sort of outspoken anti-apartheid politicians. His funeral had been held there. So this was a deeply significant cultural site in South Africa. This was the place where, you know, if they wanted a showdown, if they wanted the last African team standing to get it going, to try and get into a semi-final, this is the location they would have wanted it to be in. And I think, yeah, you would have thought at the time, okay, destiny, is it to shine down on this African nation? And what's important, you know, say this was a World Cup in Europe and all the other European teams were out and just France were still in or just Germany were still in. I don't think it'd be quite the same. I don't think everyone in Europe would then suddenly become French or German.
No, I don't think so.
I do think legitimately, the South African locals, they really wanted Ghana to win. Mm. That was important, that an African team could compete with these other nations. So, yeah, I think the romantic story was Ghana. And I think as journalist, commentator, you want that romance. And that's not to say I didn't highly respect Uruguay. And it in itself was a great story that they go through first semifinal of 40 years. But Ghana were the team who, your fairy tale was for them.
Definitely, yeah. When you describe the scene like that, it makes me even sadder that it didn't happen for them. And in such
circumstances. There's no team less likely to sort of wilt in the face of apparent destiny than Uruguay. I mean, I remember when they were in that World Cup playoff against Jordan, and I went over to Amman and I did various things with Jordan, and Prince Ali was there, and there was all this sort of huge excitement in Jordan, and this sort of sense of it's Jordan's time. And Uruguay set off for 20 minutes and beat them 5-0, and you sort of thought that is the most Uruguayan thing.
Wasn't Harry Redknapp's Jordan, was it?
No, it was. It was the Egyptian fellow who played in 1990, Hossam Hassan. But yeah, I don't think you could be around that Ghana side, particularly during that World Cup, and not sort of feel great warmth of them. The whole thing was totally chaotic. They'd had to move their training base in the first week of a tournament. So they'd gone to Sun City, which was this sort of like shopping and casino complex quite near Rustenburg. So I went to a few of their training sessions, and there was one day I was there with Neil Billingham, who I think he works for ITV in the Borders now. I think he's a newsreader up there, but he was working for Football Mundial at the time. And I knew him a bit from various Cups of Nations. And so we're standing there chatting, and Richard Kingston, the goalkeeper, he gets a whack on his calf and he comes off to ice it, and he's sitting there. And we've met him in Angola a few months earlier. So we're chatting to Richard Kingston, and he sort of, you know, realizes we're English and says, "Oh, I'm having terrible problems." And like, "Oh, why, what's going on?" And he was playing for Wigan at the time, and he lived in a village just outside Manchester. And he said, "Well, I'm getting married just after the World Cup. And I ordered these handmade shoes from Italy. And they say they delivered them, but they haven't turned up. And I'm on the phone all the time trying to sort that out." So I'm sort of thinking, what do you want me to do about it? Like, that's nothing to do with me. And so we're sort of like, "Oh, right, so where have you ordered them to?" And he names his village near Manchester. I can't remember what it was. But and Neil goes, "Oh, right, that's weird. My brother lives there." So like, "Oh, okay. What street do you live on?" "Same street." Like, this is ridiculous. So he said, "Well, I'll tell you what, I'll ring my brother, and you know, he can sort of knock on a few doors, see if it's been delivered to the wrong house." So he rings his brother and says, "Right, I'm here. You probably know him. I'm here with Richard Kingston, the Ghana goalkeeper." And his brother goes, "Oh yeah, tell him I've got his shoes. They've delivered yesterday." What are the chances of that happening?
That's amazing.
Richard Kingston was a very interesting story because he was playing for Wigan at the time. But I look back over the stats, and he didn't play a single game for Wigan that season. He wasn't even used in cup matches. And yet here he is at the World Cup, quarterfinal, the 83rd cap that night, you know. And he played well in the tournament, you know, for a guy who hadn't played club football all season. He made some big saves.
The other weird thing about him was he had a brother, Lye Kingston. His brother's name was spelled differently. He's like the Thompson twins out of Tintin, that he was Kingston and his brother was Kingston.
Well, yeah. So as loath as I am, we should probably move on to the match itself. Connor, I must ask you, actually, as a commentator, what was it like for you being surrounded by the noise of the vuvuzelas? Did that put you off?
The god-awful vuvuzelas. what's interesting is I listened back, and I didn't get through it. I listened back to the first half an hour of the commentary ahead of talking to you guys. What's really is all you can hear in the background is constant vuvuzela. I mean, for people who don't remember, these were these plastic tubes which made this very loud noise. What's really interesting for me is in that half an hour, neither myself or John Murray or Chris Waddle, none of us make any reference to the word vuvuzela or any mention to them. And what that means is we had just become tone deaf to it. Every single game since the start of the tournament had been no other noise, no singing, no cheering, no booing, just this horn of a vuvuzela. And you know, if you think nowadays, if you're at a game and a particular noise, you know, that would be mentioned in the comedy, you know, and amid the blare of the vuvuzelas, you know. But no, we had just, it was this, it's like when someone's mowing the grass in the back garden and you get used to that noise because it's there all the, you know, and you don't notice it anymore. So, undoubtedly, when I arrived, I think I even bought one at the airport. I said, "Bring that home." A newborn kid who'd just been born. I was like, you know, "That'll be a present in the future. I'll give them a vuvuzela." This, you know, it felt like a cultural gift. I don't know. They didn't even bring it home. I just left it in a hotel somewhere. I was like, these are god-awful rubbish. They were terrible.
The strange thing about that is, I mean, I totally agree with you. At the time, I hated them. But, you know, you very kindly sent over a clip of your commentary, you know, the audio of your commentary. And so I listened back to some of it. And actually, it was really evocative. It sort of took me back to being there. So I think it's one of those things that, in retrospect, sounds quite good. But at the time, it was just awful. I don't know if it's
like
different.
For me, it's like when you eat, I personally don't like coriander. And the reason I don't like, you know, one little tiny atom of a leaf of coriander, I think, that's a pleasing taste. But if you put a sprinkle of coriander in your dish, all you can taste for me is coriander. You can't taste the other ingredients. And that's what the vuvuzela was for me. It took away, I wanted to hear the African chants. And they had great songs, the African supporters, but you couldn't hear them. All you could hear was the vuvuzela.
Yeah, I was a bit of a hypocrite because I was moaning on when I was watching it on TV back in England and saying, "Hey, it's bloody noise," and everybody complaining about it. But actually the other Football Ramble lads and I, we managed to get out there for the sort of latter stages. And as soon as we got there, handed a vuvuzela, I was absolutely loving it. I brought a couple home and they're loud, like every now and then pop outside and give it a little toot. But yeah, anyway, let's talk about the match itself. So the match is played, as you say, in Soccer City in Johannesburg, and it gets underway, and it's, I mean, Jonathan, your sort of thoughts on the first half? I can't remember too many sort of major incidents. There was a few sort of half chances and whatnot, but what did you make of the first half?
Yeah, I mean, it was pretty tight. There was a couple of headed chances. Isaac Forster put a very good header just wide from a corner, but it was fairly tight. And then your first half injury time, and it was a goal that was sort of so typical of a tournament that Montari got the ball, what, 35 yards out, maybe even further than that. Hits it. You know, he's not closed down, which, you know, I'm sure Tabárez was furious about, given Tabárez's obsession with shape. So he's not closed down. He's given the opportunity to have a shot. I'm not even sure he hit it that hard, but it just sort of swerves enough to wrong foot Muslera, and it just sort of bounces in the corner. And so, you know, normally you'd think, you know, 35-yard strike, brilliant. In context, a 35-yard strike that showed the failure of the ball.
Yeah, well, a 35-yard strike from Montari as well, who could hit them, of course. But Conor, I mean, that was, it gave us something, didn't it? Just before half time, and you think, oh, hang on a minute, the narrative is unfolding right here. You know, being commentating on that game, you must have started thinking, my goodness, are we going to witness the first African side ever to reach a World Cup semi-final?
Yeah, goals before halftime are always good news. I think, you know, in a game commenting 0-0, you know it's going to be a flat enough discussion at halftime if it is scoreless. But you get that late goal, then suddenly everything changes. Right, Uruguay now need to adjust their tactics. Do Ghana feel 1-0 is enough? Can they defend? You know, it really gives you a narrative to discuss. Montari had been an interesting one. He was with Inter Milan at the time. He had been at Portsmouth before that, and it was actually his first start of the tournament, because he'd been excluded from the team, and he'd had a row with the coach. I don't know what it was all about, but something to, you know, they had a clash of personalities, and the coach said, well, I'm the coach, you're out, you know. And it wasn't quite Roy Keane in Saipan, he wasn't sent home, but he was, you know, a peripheral member, and he only came back.
Well, he'd been dropped from the Cup of Nations. He wasn't in the Cup of Nations squad, and the reason was there was three of them who got dropped because they didn't turn up for a friendly, and Rajovac, the coach, said, right, we've just won the Under-20 World Cup. I'd rather promote these kids than have senior players who can't be bothered to turn for friendlies. So that was the friction between them.
Mm. And Montari, anyway, starts in this game, first start to the tournament. So for him to score the goal, felt, oh, you know, maybe this is the extra element that they've been missing. This is going to be the difference that'll get them into the semi-final. I mean, this guy had just won the Champions League, I believe, that year with Inter. I think they won Serie A as well. You know, so he was a star player who hadn't been involved, and then comes in and scores that goal, and you feel, right, what is Oscar Tabárez, this Uruguay coach, going to do? I mean, Tabárez, if you were casting him in a movie, I think it would have to be a sort of a cop movie. You'd have the two renegade sort of cops who don't obey the rules, and they'd be Suarez and Cavani, or Suarez and Forlan. And then Tabárez would be the sort of long-suffering chief of police who, you know, he's really tough on them, and he doesn't let them away with much, but it's because he loves them. You know, he doesn't want them to get hurt out in the field, but, you know, disciplinarian, but with this soft side that he loves. He'd got that, you know, concerned, worried expression on his face going to the dressing room. Okay, I've got this team of stars, you know, Ghana, right, they've got the African connection, but really, you know, this is a team you'd feel confident before the tournament. If we got them in the quarters, we would expect to beat them. We would expect to go through. And yet he was 1-0 down. So that Montari goal had changed it. Now, suddenly this was roll up your sleeve stuff for Uruguay. And a bit like I've been watching the early stages of this Michael Jordan documentary, The Last Dance. And I think quarterfinals in general, they've got a bit of that Last Dance about it. I think any team that gets further than a quarterfinal, they never get slated. They never had a disastrous tournament. You know, they gave it a really good go. Whereas it's a pivotal moment. You know, if Uruguay were knocked out in that quarterfinal, they would have gone home saying, right, you've underperformed this tournament. Once you win that game, then anything is a lottery from then on. No one's going to criticize you too much. So it had that Last Dance feel about it. We are 1-0 down. We are in the home of African football here. We're against an African team. We need something special here. We have got to, basically, gloves are off, which I think became the mentality that led to the big climax of this game.
Yeah, I think I completely agree with regards to what you're saying about teams getting to the semi-final, with the obvious exception of Brazil in 2014.
Yes,
but,
yes.
But you know, with the kind of cop analogy, I mean, Diego Forlán is in among those players, maybe a slight Serpico kind of vibe about him.
Yes.
And of course, he's the man who, a bit more clean living than the others perhaps, but he's the man who's, as you say, the player of the tournament. He would be crowned, of course, at the end of it. He's the man that gets the goal. And again, Jonathan, you're looking at that Jabulani football. The way he hits that free kick, it moves around a little bit, and you'd be looking at the goalkeeper a bit. But again, the ball had made its mark on the game.
Well, I think in normal circumstances, you'd be looking at the keeper. I think in this tournament, you just had to accept. I mean, I think what you realised was within sort of, after sort of two or three games, the better players had worked out how to strike the ball. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't about trying to hit it hard. It was about getting it on target, and it might wobble about. So Keisuke Honda scored those two goals against Denmark for Japan. Very similar, of just sort of putting the ball there or thereabouts and waiting for the ball to do something. And that was what this was. You know, free kick out on the left, and he sort of, you know, bends it over the wall or clips it over the wall, and it seems to be curving into the near post, and suddenly it straightens up, and Kingston, you know, can't get back, and yeah, ends up going around the top corner and looks like this very pure strike. But I don't think there's any way a player, not even, you know, even a player of Forlan's class, could judge that. He was just putting the ball towards that side of the goal and relying on it to wobble enough to defeat Kingston.
Mm. So it's 1-1, and the second half kind of trundles on. And from my recollection, Connor, and sort of looking back on it, it certainly felt, again, this is my heart talking probably, but it felt like Ghana were getting a little bit of the better of it, although there was a good save from a Luis Suarez shot. But it was I'm sure the feeling in the stadium would have been a lot of the local support and obviously the Ghanaian support almost sort of trying to suck that ball into the back of the net.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'm trying to remember back to the game. Definitely there was a feeling that Ghana could have nicked it. They had a few chances, and then, you know, yet right at the end, I remember the free kick that led to the sort of real drama was Uruguay were proper 11 men back behind the ball. At this stage, Sebastian Abreu had come on. He was the centre forward, and he was brought back to defend. We mentioned that in the commentary, you know, that his height in defence was going to be there. So it wasn't the case of Uruguay, you know, let's leave a player up while they push forward for a free kick. We might nick it. They were backs to the wall at that stage. They were thinking our best outcome from here is penalty shootout rather than trying to win this game before spot kicks. But, you know, look, it is a long time ago, so I'm struggling to remember the exact detail on that.
I think Kevin Prince-Boateng may have had a header which he put just wide, Jonathan, and it was a decent chance. But as Connor said, you know, as the game went on, it got sort of deeper into, and then into extra time, of course, and so on. It did feel like, I remember watching it thinking, I think Ghana might, they could nick this. I didn't think that there was too much danger of Uruguay scoring.
Yeah, I mean, I think Abreu coming on was Tabara sort of saying, this is going to penalties, because Abreu is a penalty specialist. You know, he scored a series of crucial penalties in shootouts. That's what he's really good at. So, you know, I think that substitution was made with the shootout in mind. But yeah, those last 3 or 4 minutes, from memory, was pretty much all Ghana. And they'd had a couple of corners, and then they get the key free kick. And that, you know, again, your memory sort of tricks you with this. I sort of, you know, my memory of it was, oh, the ball comes in, there's a header, it's punched off the line. But actually, it's a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah.
There's a whole load goes on.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, even looking back on it, Connor, I mean, Ghana, they might have scored before the header and then the handball. There was a shot that was cleared off the line. There was a scramble. And again, if you're Ghanaian and you watch that back, you know, I don't know if you even could, because the handball may have been completely irrelevant and the penalty, because there was a chance to put the ball in the back of the net and it wasn't taken.
Well, and this, I think the you know, when you talk about the famous handball incident, is that there's a double save, and the first time it's blocked legitimately. I think this is important. You know, it's not that this is blatantly just breaking the rules for the sake of it. I mean, the first one was, we can keep it out with a head. Second one, no, a head isn't going to do this time. Hand is going to have to be used. And it was that, you know, by any means necessary, what can be done. And I think, you know, I'd actually forgotten about in the build-up, you know, the whole thing with the ball, and Jonathan describes it so well. I think it added this element of everything's a bit up for grabs here. Everything is, you know, you just get it in the mixer. Anything could happen because this ball is such a random thing. And I think, you know, the Frank Lampard goal for England gets a lot of talk. There was that there had also been a sort of injustice goal because I commentated on the game when Argentina beat Mexico and Tevez was way offside for it was 0-0. Tevez scored, Messi prodded onto him. He was way offside. And I remember in the stadium, they actually put the replay up on the big screen so everyone could see in the stadium. And there's no doubt, I mean, that tournament was the catalyst that set in motion what led to video assistant refereeing and video technology being used, because people felt these were the big injustices. But also, nothing was being done about the injustice. You know, you would get through even if there was an injustice, which I think is in the background of the narrative here, where, okay, we'll try, we'll stretch, we'll do every sinew to keep the ball out fairly. But if it's a case that you can't keep it out fairly, your decision is, well, do you concede the goal or do you commit a crime against football, if you like? Do you take the law into your own hand? Do you risk suspension, not just for a semi-final, but maybe a two-match ban that would get you into the final? You know, how far are you willing to go? And that question was never going to be dwelt upon too long by Suarez. I mean, it's by all means, whatever has to be done, I'm going to do it.
And it wasn't just Suarez. I mean, Fusile tried to handle it in front of him. Fusile missed it, which allowed Suarez to make the save. But it had been Suarez who blocked Steven Appiah's shot. And you think of what might have been. Okay, you think of Dominic Adaya, this kid who's come off the bench, and obviously it would have been great for him. But if Steven Appiah had scored the goal, that's the fairy story. I mean, he was only 29, but he had the body of a 49-year-old. You know, he'd been broken by football. Yeah. I'm not even sure if he'd actually been in the squad at the Cup of Nations, because he just had these horrific knee injuries over and over again. And what a wonderful footballer he had been before the injuries. And if it had been him who got the winner, that would have felt, that would have been the perfect finale to that game. But, his shot's blocked and then there's a header and then there's the two attempts at handling it, the second of which works.
Yeah, of course. And we really, if people didn't know much about Luis Suarez before that game or even before the tournament, we certainly found out. I mean, he handles it. The red card is produced and the surprised look on his face is wonderful, and of course off he goes and he's in tears, and then Jan steps up to take the penalty, and looking back at the game, Connor, there's a couple of the Ghanaian players who are properly really celebrating when the red card's given, the penalty's given. They thought, yes, here we go, and you can understand that, of course. And up steps Jan, their main man, and of course hits the top of the crossbar.
Yeah, I mean, afterwards Suarez claims he said it was the save of the tournament. The quote is a brilliant quote. He said, "The hand of God belongs to me now. Mine is the real hand of God." I mean, he took it as pride. So I remember. So our commentary position was behind the tunnel. The goal where all this was happening was to the right hand side. Suarez gets sent off, and as happens at these big tournaments, there's various people to kind of usher you away. You know, once you've left the pitch, they don't want you hanging around. They don't want you being. You know, you're gone now. Down the tunnel. And he's been ushered down by a member of FIFA staff, but he lingers. He doesn't go, and he stays at the mouth of the tunnel and he looks back. He's in tears, Suarez. He's been sent off. Jan has got a penalty. This is 120 minutes into the game. This is, we had played the full amount of stoppage time before the penalty had been awarded. It legitimately was to be the last kick of the game. If Jan scores, Uruguay are out, and the penalty would have been given away by Suarez. And okay, he'll say, well, it was going in anyway. But the bottom line, I've been sent off, I've given away a penalty, and we're going out of the World Cup. He lingers. The guy is literally pulling his arm, but he's stretching, straining his neck back that he can see it. Jan runs up to hit the penalty, hits the crossbar, and Suarez, there's no tears anymore. Celebration. Clenched fist. He runs down the tunnel then. It was all worth it. The end had justified the means. Because if he hadn't handled the ball, Uruguay were out. He had handled it. They were still in.
And you just knew, Jonathan, that Uruguay were going to win on penalties when that happened. But when, because Forlan, I think, took the first one and scores. Jan, to be fair to him, steps up and takes the first penalty.
I very rarely wanted anybody to score a penalty as much as I wanted Jan to score that. Having seen what he'd gone through 2 years earlier, the thought of him missing, two penalties in, 5 minutes, 10 minutes? In a World Cup quarter final, I was delighted for him that he scored that.
Yeah, that was a good fair play to him. I think he put it top corner.
And also, I was expecting at the time, and I think I said in the commentary, you expect this kind of redemption celebration. Think Stuart Pearce when he scored at Euro 96, you know, this, okay, I have missed an important penalty for my country, but now I've scored one, you know, clenched fist, red face. It wasn't, it was this almost polite applause from Jan, almost an apology of a cell. Okay, I hope I've made some amends here. I know it doesn't completely rectify, but I mean, these are the worst circumstances. I mean, nobody wants to be involved in a penalty shootout, knockout stages of a World Cup, but this is the worst circumstance when you've been given a penalty to win the game and you've missed that penalty. So you're not feeling altogether happy about penalties. Forlan comes up, I mentioned before, you know, juggling the ball in one hand. He's like playing with his kids in the back garden, no problem, slots it home. And Jan walks up first for Gad. I mean, if he'd missed that, you know, it's all over there and then. But he puts it in the top corner. He did with the second penalty what he meant to do the first time. And then, and on it went from there.
I mean, Ghana had to go through for him to feel any sort of redemption, of course. And as the penalty shootout would go on, Muslera became the hero, despite Ghana, a Uruguayan penalty being skied over the crossbar. And when Uruguay went through, of course, Abreu, as his name was mentioned before, Jonathan, he steps up to take the winning penalty.
And he's just, so I'm really sorry to interrupt, but you cannot skip in the narrative the very important John Mensah penalty. John Mensah, the Sunderland defender, who, you know, when you play five-a-side football and you're awarded a penalty, the thing to make it fair, you can't just blast it past the goalkeeper. You can only take one step, which makes it more difficult to get by. You know, that is a rule of five-a-side football. He decided in a World Cup quarterfinal penalty shootout, Why would you take a few steps to run up? Why not just take a one-step penalty? It was a terrible kick. Muslera saves it, and that's what gave the advantage to Uruguay. But then, of course, Maxi Pereira blazes over the top. And you got to remember as well, I'm sitting beside Chris Waddle here, who knows a little bit more about blazing penalties over the top in World Cup knockout games. So that felt very significant as well. And this, you know, these were all the little moments. You put them all together and you realize what a dramatic game that this was. But the John Mensah pathetic penalty, I mean, for me, you know, Jan did his best, you know. And although there is one thing about this, I always think if your penalty is wide or hits the crossbar, that must feel worse than if it's saved. At least you say, if it's saved, look, I hit it on target, I did my bit, the goalkeeper chose the right side, he was okay. If you don't hit the target, if it's wide, if it's hit the crossbar, I think that's what must really hurt the player who's missed the penalty, because you feel, God, you know, just do, you've one job here, hit the bloody thing on target. And if you don't hit the target, you know, from 12 yards, that must eat you up inside.
But the thing with John Mensah, he's such a huge bloke, you know, a real sort of bull of a man, you know, this centre back, you know, just full of muscle. Just smack the thing. Yeah. Like, even if you smack it straight down the middle, it only has to, you know, it's a Jabalani, it's going to wobble. It only has to wobble 18 inches and it's in, because you can hit, he can hit the ball so hard. So this little stabby side foot. Yeah.
And just then, and in the context,
why would you do
of
that
as
a centre back?
Yeah, and in the context of this, having seen this, you know, fancy penalty, if you like, this one touch penalty, one step penalty fail, for then Sebastian Abreu to step forward, tall, muscly, long hair, South American Adonis, puts the ball down, and you're expecting, right, here comes hot shot Hamish. He is going to lift the net off the back of the ground. He runs up. This was the year where Jan Kermagant had fluffed a Panenka for Leicester, remember? But he runs up and he just dinks it. He does the most cheeky Panenka dink. Goalkeeper chooses a side and dives, and it floats over and in. And to have done that, to have the balls to do that after what had happened with the penalty before, it meant John Mensah's attempt. I think that was audacious. I mean, I remember that
it was,
really took my breath away.
But that is what Abreu always did. That was his penalty.
It was his trademark.
So
I think.
I might be wrong about this, but I think in the quarterfinal of a Copa America the following year against Argentina, in Argentina, I think he took the same penalty then. And I guess this is sort of just long enough ago that goalkeepers didn't have. I mean, I know Lehmann in 2006 had his bit of hotel notepaper with the instructions of where everybody was going to put them. But I think this is before, you know, that was taken hugely seriously. Because I think now Abreu goalkeepers would be told to stand still because that's what he does. But you're right. In the context, it felt like the most audacious penalty since Panenka.
No, it did. And what I feel is, you know, even if the goalkeeper knew that, even look, we're all second guessing here, but even if he knew, right, this guy likes Panenkas, I still think you would think, okay, Mensah has just tried this silly short run up and fluffed it. this is a kick to win. He's not going to do the Panenka here. You know, he is going to put, you know, I'm going to pick a corner. This is not, he would never be brave enough. He's going to sky it over the crossbar if he tries. It just, you know, you listen to the commentary, the way we do the commentaries in the radio, those big games, we've got two commentators, is we each take a team. So John Murray, my colleague, was commentating on the Uruguay penalties, and I was commentating on the Ghana penalty. Now, one of the big rules are, both their microphones are open. One of the big rules of commentary is, you know, you don't shout over someone else's big moment. And there's obviously been a few famous examples over the years where a summarizer goes, ah, gets all excited in the background of a big moment. And the commentator hates that because, no, you're supposed to be listening to my word. This is my big moment. But when the Panenka is hit by Abreu, you can hear me in the back. I'm just going, no way. You know? Which that is not what was expected. It was just one of those moments where you feel somebody somewhere is sitting in their car and they've arrived home 25 minutes ago. Their wife is inside. The dinner is going cold or it's burning in the oven. They should have left their car, but they cannot turn the radio off. They cannot go into the house because they are glued to this. And it was one of those moments you go, wow, and what a finale then to this thrilling intrigue.
It was, and it felt like it was almost, it couldn't have been more disrespectful to the narrative that we all wanted and the sort of Africa's hope in this Ghana football team to reach that semi-final. Because as you say, had they have reached the semi-final, they would have, you know, you're in with a fighting chance. It would have been unlikely if they'd have beaten the Netherlands, but you're in a fighting chance to reach the final. You know, people could really dream and really remember, but they were stopped short of that through Luis Suarez's handball.
Important. Then what happens is the celebrations. So having been sent off to the dressing room, Luis Suarez is out, and not only is he sort of sheepishly, you know, I'm thinking of Roy Keane in the 99 semi-final where he scored the goal against Juventus, but he knows he won't play in the final, and the reality of that is kind of coming in. Suarez is being lifted up on the shoulders of teammates. I mean, it is the adoration. This was the plan all along. This has worked out. You are the hero. This is the guy who's been sent off. And that, you know, so you multiply the Panenka penalty, multiplied the scenario of Suarez's cheek and poor Ghanaians and they didn't leave. They stayed out on the pitch as well. You know, it's like, has this actually happened? It wasn't, you know, the beaten team often leaves and the fans leave and you get one half of a stadium celebrating. The Ghanaians all stayed out of the pitch for a long, long time afterwards. They were shell shocked. They looked like they'd seen a ghost and yeah, carried literally up on the shoulders of his teammates. Like Pele having won the World Cup, or Bobby Moore is the better example, actually. Like Bobby Moore, that's what it was. It was Bobby Moore up on the shoulders, except it's Suarez. And what are they celebrating? The fact he was sent off and gave a penalty.
It was offensive. I'd go as far to say it was offensive. it's why we love football, because you have these incredible moments. Connor, it's been a pleasure unpacking
that
one with you.
Really good. Yeah, really, really good. Yeah.
Well, for more stories like that, ladies and gentlemen, do check out theblizzard.co.uk. But yeah, poor old Ghana. Oh, dearie me. I'm going to have a pick-me-up after that. But Connor, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, guys. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan, as always. And thank you, everybody, for listening to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. We'll see you next week.
They all stand arms around one another. It is Abreu! It's the cheekiest chip you've ever seen. And it's good enough to take the South Americans into the semi-finals of the World Cup. African hearts are finally broken in 2010. There will be no African team in the last four.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we're way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.